Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This week on The Wheelhouse. The War on Woke. And a little later, ranked choice voting. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse, the show that connects politics to people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond right here. I first heard the word woke back in 2014. It was during the protests against the police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Back then, stay woke was a rallying cry around issues of social and racial justice. We also know that now, in doing some research in the show, we know that this term goes back many years, back to the 30s, maybe even beyond that. Fast forward to now, and we're hearing that word in a much different context.
We say very clearly in the state of Florida, we will fight the woke in the legislature. We will fight the woke in education. We will fight the woke in the businesses. We will never, ever surrender to the woke mob. Our state is where woke goes to die.
That's Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, one of several Republican politicians rallying against wokeness in both rhetoric and policy. So what does this mean for us? What does this mean for us here in Connecticut? And how could this play out in the 2024 elections? To break down all that and more, we got three great guests with us. I'm excited for this. First of all, Dr. Bilal Sekou, Hillier College Associate Professor of Politics and Government from the University of Hartford. Good morning, Dr. Sekou.
Go Hawks!
He says go Hawks. He's also a fan of the Ohio State University. That's very in your face. If you're a fan of the University of Connecticut and you've watched the NCAA tournament, a lot of hate in that man's heart. Mordecai Gordon, the professor of education from Quinnipiac University, is also the author of Education in a Cultural War Era, Thinking Philosophically About the Practice of Canceling. Good morning, Mordecai.
Good morning. And let me remind you that we're in the Frozen Four, the Quinnipiac Bobcats. So.
Absolutely are. For the third time in history and perhaps maybe a first national championship, Quinnipiac hockey. We got a lot of sports here today. Eric L. McDaniel, we're going to get down to business with here with you, the Associate Professor of Government and Co-Director of the Politics of Race and Ethnicity Lab at the University of Texas at Austin. And you also could see his work in Time as well. Good morning, Eric.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. We appreciate it. And if you want to join in on this conversation, I already see the phone lines are buzzing, so you're going to want to make sure you give us a call. 888-720-9677, 888-720-WNPR. Eric, I want to start with the basics here. How do we define woke or wokeness and... That's obviously the historical versus how we're seeing it now.
Historically, woke is something that Black Americans have used, basically being aware of what's going on, being aware of how they, of really threats to them. So you can think of being aware of the Klan, things like that, but also how the system may affect them. As it's become more public, it's kind of, I guess for lack of a better word, kind of been gentrified where everybody's kind of used it, but it's something that you can think of in terms of Blacks being aware of their situation. And I think the best example of it, this is dated, if you think about the movie School Days, at the very end of it, Larry Fishburne kind of rings the bell at the HBCU telling everybody to wake up. And be aware of what's going on and be aware of the various things that are damaging the group.
1988 film directed and written by Spike Lee, School Days. And to you traditionally here, you mentioned that term, but obviously, and what it's meant historically and how it's resonated, but there's woke and now there's woke pejorative. A recent USA Today poll found that 56% of Americans think woke means to be informed, educated on, and aware of social injustices. Okay. 39% say that it means to be overly politically correct and police others' words. And this is where woke pejorative comes into play here. Bilal and Mordecai, do you or more or less agree? What else would you add with what we're hearing so far about the term woke and how it's being used so far or how it's being used today?
Why don't you go ahead, Mordecai?
Okay, thank you. No, I agree with Eric's definition and the historical roots that dated back to the 1930s, Frank, that you mentioned, Frankie. But today it's complicated because it's been weaponized by people like Governor DeSantis that you played in the clip before. And others like Huckabee Sanders that treated as a pejorative treat, but that's on from the right of the political spectrum. But from the left, sometimes you get criticized, and I've experienced this personally. Maybe we can talk about later that people coming and criticizing you for not being woke enough. It's a complicated kind of term that is being played by both right and left. I'm not trying to make a false equivalency, but my main point, and I wrote an op-ed in the Seek, is that we need to have a nuanced conversation like what we're having now. And right now, we don't even have any conversation. It's basically, monologues and people like rants like DeSantis. But there should be a nuanced conversation, a rigorous nuanced conversation about woke.
I want to talk to you, Mordecai, more in a little bit about where we can have these kind of conversations. But first, Bilal, I want to hear what you have to say on this.
Sure. I think both Eric and Mordecai have really hit on the history of the term wokeness. What I'm struck by certainly is resonance with so many whites in the United States today. I think some of it, is a reflection of, anxiety that stems from, worries about the changing demographics that are occurring in the country. The fact that, people are projecting by mid-century, this may be a majority minority country, a majority non-white country. And that is creating a lot of anxiety, worries about the erosion of power and privilege that whites have historically had in American society is really unsettling. The other thing that strikes me about particularly its, use when we think of it in pejorative term is really at its core is it's an attack on progressive values. And so in many ways, it's now the substitute for the word socialism that used to be thrown at the left whenever you talked about, sort of promoting equity, for example, that's a socialist agenda, or, trying to protect the environment, that's a socialist agenda. Now, wokeness has become that kind of term. A good example of that in terms of its broader use, even beyond race and how it affects progressive values. South Carolina recently, legislation is moving in about its Retirement System Investment Commission. And, that legislation would block any efforts to invest in anything that doesn't produce or maximize profit. And so what it's really directed at is any sort of investment decisions that are based on climate change or perhaps social impacts. And so I think this term, certainly the way it's been used in the racial context is, well known to a lot of people, but I think it's a broader attack on progressive values in the country.
I want to, as we continue this conversation here, I want to bring in somebody who's going to talk about woke pejorative here. And that's a friend we have in Manchester. Tom, go ahead. What's your comment here? we're going to step aside here and continue our conversation and bring Tom in a second when we can. Just wanted to continue on this thought that we're talking about here. We talked a bit about the history, but I want to zoom in a little bit more here with you, Eric, and seeing this resurgence in using the word following the early days of the Black Lives Matter movement. We were talking about Ferguson earlier. Can you take us from Ferguson to, I guess, just around the time where this word really became misappropriated by people like Ron DeSantis?
I think it's really, if you think around the 2020 election, a little bit before that, where you had President Trump actively opposing Black Lives Matter protesters, then also think of the Women's March. So there's a lot of pressure and a lot of pushback against what you would see as the status quo. And so what you see is individuals who are trying to defend the status quo, or in many ways kind of revert things back regarding race, gender, sexuality, and even income, start to use woke as a way to, as a bit of a dog whistle. So one of the things we do know is that there is a strong racial aspect to the word woke. Just as we know that when we ask people, protesting, Americans protesting is good, they say yes. Black Americans protesting, good. Oh, no. And the issue here is that it's seen as a threat, as, you know, as Professor Sekou pointed out, this is a threat to the establishment. This is a threat to privilege. And by being woke means you're aware of how power can be abused. Problem is, the people in power think that they are justified in it and that those who are woke are trying to take away or unjustified in taking away that power.
Just a reminder, you can actually call in and join the conversation with us here with Mordecai, Bilal, Eric, and I. 888-720-9677, 888-720-WNPR. Have you seen anti-wokeness play out in our Connecticut community here? Tell us about it if you can. I want to hear from Tom in Manchester, who joins us now on the show, to talk about woke pejorative. (888) 720-9677, the number to call. Can't get Tom on with us here so far, but we're going to ask a quick question. Actually, it looks like we have Tom. Tom, go ahead if you're there.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Tom.
Yes,
what do you have to say?
I have an African-American background. I've done what I can do in Manchester to promote cultural diversity over the years, and I think woke is just a ethnocentric reaction from certain parts of the white establishment and conservatives of color too, such as Candace Owens and others, to, I wouldn't say keep people down, but keep us divided when they use the word Marxism, like Mark Levin, his book 2 years ago, American Marxism, against Howard Zinn and other dead authors. I think that's wrong, but what it is right now, we're heading towards progress and there's some issues with the economy and everything gets sorted. I guess you have to look at someone as a scapegoat. So, you know, even if you're a poor white or something like that, could still look down upon somebody else that's homeless, and we're at that mark right now. We should be pulling together instead of pulling apart. So I think we've got the racism and the resurgence of these hate groups and neo-Nazis and anti-Semitism too, and, you know, other effective groups. So I think it's a class issue, and the politics and power, you know, from Fox News and some conservatives and liberals too. You know, we can't live in the past. We've got to move forward. And I think we're, you know, it's seen as a socioeconomic threat whenever you talk about it. You know, people want to pull in the reins, and it shouldn't be that way. I think it's a government for all of us, and we need to, you know, do better. And I stand tall on my principle because I'm born here and I die here, and I'll never let racism, pummel me as well. I will speak out on issues, and if some whites don't like it, that's too bad. It's a free country, and we can agree to disagree. So that's my point on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. Thank you for calling in today. Tom from Manchester, thank you for calling into the Wheelhouse. And now, Bilal, that we're kind of establishing what woke and wokeness means, how would you characterize this anti-woke movement?
I think we're jumping ahead if we really believe we've established what it means. I think the challenge of dealing with this anti-wokeness sure. effort or project that we see going on is the problem of people who argue about it aren't able to really effectively define it. And so I think, you know, we're maybe jumping ahead when we talk as if this is a sort of coherent sort of agenda. And I think it's a hodgepodge of ideas that are sort of thrown up against the wall to attack, again, I think more broadly, progressive values, whether it's LGBTQ, whether it's around race, you know, all of these things are tossed up against the wall. But one of the things I am struck by about this movement, and Eric sort of hinted at this as well, is about the way in which this is really designed to sort of block the teaching to anyone about issues of privilege or oppression. And so what I'm struck by this effort also is that it's about erasing history and also the erasing the effects of that history on the present. And so to silence conversations about the historical role of housing segregation in our society, its impact on wealth inequality today, looking at education and educational inequities and looking at the disparities in access and opportunity for quality education, looking at the history of our criminal justice system and the racial impacts of that system. And so what people like DeSantis and others are trying to do is they're trying to erase that history and to eliminate any sort of discussion about those impacts today. And that takes us to some of the way in which people have gone after CRT, which is not being taught in K-12, but it becomes sort of a catchword that everyone can jump onto.
Mordecai, we're talking with you about nuance in this conversation because of this recent piece that you had in the Connecticut Post. What would a nuanced conversation kind of look and sound like if we could dive a little deeper into this? Where can it take place? Is it on shows like this? Is it in the classroom? What do you got?
Yeah, all of the above, shows like this in the classroom, and I agree with everything that my two colleagues are saying. I just want to kind of push them further a little bit, and so what? Not only where that conversation can take place in any kind of public forum, on the radio, on TV, but what should we be discussing? So one of the things that we've all kind of taken our turns to criticize, Ron DeSantis's efforts to demonize woke, but we could have a nuanced conversation about what should be the don't say gay law that he, what should be we, because my field is education, what should we be teaching in K-3 the young kids about gender identity, sexual identity? That's an important conversation to be had. But right now we're not having that conversation because we're using just the term woke as a kind of boogeyman or as, you know, anti-progressive, like Bilal was saying. But can really have a conversation, because I think that it is worthy to ask, and it's not automatic that kids in kindergarten should be exposed to the same things that kids in high school or in the universities. So that kind of conversation is a worthy conversation to be had.
Bilal, we've seen some prominent anti-woke politicians and activists struggle to define wokeness recently. So maybe that's why you're kind of saying, I don't know if we've established this kind of thing yet, but I guess we got to talk about this big time viral clip. I know you've seen it, most notably this conservative commentator. Her name is Bethany Mandel. Let's hear a clip.
So, I mean, woke is sort of the idea that this is going to be one of those moments that goes viral. I mean, woke is something that's very hard to define, and we've spent an entire chapter defining it.
Oh, and it did go viral. And what does this kind of struggle tell us, Bilal?
Exactly what she said, that woke is really difficult to define. And again, I think what is sort of great about the term for those who use it is it's quite malleable, and you can attack whatever you want to attack and describe it as being woke. I just wanted to, you know, sort of go back to something that Mordecai said, and I think he's absolutely right. You know, but I think part of why we're at this place is because people have challenged the curriculum that is being, that had been used in the schools. And so when I think about growing up in the Detroit public schools, what I learned about Black history tended to be Harriet Tubman, Booker T. Washington, a little bit about Rosa Parks, a little bit about Martin Luther King, and that was Black history. And so, you know, what people are doing now, and I think it's the right conversation to have, and we've been having that conversation, is really challenging the way in which we talk about, you know, the history of the country, the way in which we talk about identity. We're seeing people who have been pushed to the margins of the periphery of our society, who are refusing to be in the periphery, in the margins, who are challenging a, you know, an educational curriculum that centers whiteness, that centers masculinity, that centers heterosexuality. And I think that's a good conversation. And I think Mordecai is correct that we need to really go deeper into that conversation, but with the understanding that there are a lot of people who are very opposed to having that conversation and are much more comfortable with the curriculum that centers whiteness, that centers the history of Western society and normalize it and talks as if it is the way and it's the best way and the only way in which we need to understand our world that we live in.
This conversation we're having right here, you can join in on it if you'd like, 888-720-9677, 888-720-WNPR. Are you seeing anti-wokeness in your Connecticut town or city? Tell us about it. We'll talk more about wokeness and anti-wokeness that you might be seeing here in Connecticut after the break.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davida Umashankar, Hartford HealthCare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umashankar has advice on the first most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. And if you're just joining us, we've been talking about the rise of the anti-woke movement and what that could mean for 2024 elections. It's woke pejorative versus woke. Still with me, we have our guest, Dr. Bilal Sekou, the Hillier College Associate Professor of Politics and Government at the University of Hartford, Mordecai Gordon, Professor of Education at Quinnipiac University, and Eric McDaniel, the Associate Professor of Government and Co-Director of Politics of Race and Ethnicity Lab at the University of Texas at Austin. And joining us now on the phone, we have somebody calling in from Coventry. Here's Jeff. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hi.
What's your comment?
My comment is that I'm a big fan of Bill Maher, and he often talks about how the woke movement is actually shutting down some conversations about certain things. And I'm not sure what that's about. Have you heard anything about people being silenced at or universities and things like that, where, I think the conversation should go on both ways. And I just want to hear more about that.
Thank you for calling in, Jeff. I appreciate your comment here. And really what I want to do here is I want to go back to Mordecai, because this is kind of that conversation that we're having about nuance. But then I really want Eric to respond to this call. Go ahead, Mordecai. You go first.
Yeah, I can respond directly to Jeff's question. And I'm also a fan of Bill Maher, because I think we do need conversations and not to shut them down. And I can give an example from my own experience of with this thing now that we've been in the news also, which is called land acknowledgments, with for Native American, to acknowledge their existence here. And so I recently, at a curriculum review committee meeting of the university, questioned if you're teaching a math course and whether you should include that because what are the students supposed to make, with a paragraph, with a land acknowledgement in a math course, which is decontextualized, they don't even see the connection. And people didn't even like the fact that I raised the question. So the point is that we should encourage questioning people, whether we agree with them or not. And anytime people try to kind of shut you up and say, that's not a legitimate question, that's the kind of thing that I think concerns me and concerns Bill Maher and others.
Yeah, but and Eric, though, we're hearing a lot of the woke pejorative. So I would imagine there's an effort to kind of stop that, and especially in the rhetoric that's happening. What are your thoughts here, Eric, based on what you're hearing?
Yeah, and this is kind of goes back to what I said earlier about woke being gentrified, of where it's been taken away from the people who actually invented it and were trying to advance it. And you're seeing woke being used by individuals in a disingenuous way, that it's a way for certain groups to maintain the power that they have. You know, I've had talked to high school teachers who are at these extremely wealthy schools where kids, you know, their parents have master's degrees and make well above the median, talking about check your privilege. But a lot of it is a way for people to kind of skate away from what they have. I think one of the things about woke is, you notice Black people aren't using woke anymore. So it's kind of like how I think you had politicians doing the dab and that died. I think a lot of times there are certain people started using woke and Black people like, okay, we're no longer using that because they've taken it out of our hands. And I do believe that woke is important in the sense that you're aware of what has happened and you're able to have a nuanced conversation about the good, the bad, and the ugly. But with the rise of Christian nationalism, with really a fragility of many people's egos, that you can't have this conversation. And this is not new. This is something that has happened since the founding of the nation. It happened during the Civil War. If you think about the way in which the South re-envisioned itself after the Civil War, you know, in many ways, the way the Great Southern Myth has now become the Great National Myth. And that is what you see coming out of Governor DeSantis. You see this coming out of President Trump and a lot of people pushing for this so-called patriotism, which is really nationalism in disguise.
We have a phone call we're going to go to right now. We have actually a state representative on the line. Go ahead, Christine Palm. Very nice to have you call in this morning. What do you have to say?
Christine Palm here. Thank you for the show. Thanks to the learned professors for all the wonderful points you're making. Woke is the past tense of wake, as in wake up. And as a politician who's in the majority, both as a Democrat and as a white person, I think it's time that a lot of us woke up to the oppression in our country, as the professors have said. And it's so obvious to some of us. You look at the national headlines about the shooting that took place, and we have to point out that this is a trans person, the first trans shooter, after hundreds and hundreds of mass shootings by white men, and we never see a headline that says another angry young white man shoots a bunch of people. Why is that? So if that's a woke agenda, sign me up, because we really, really need to start calling this stuff what it is. It is racism, homophobia, misogyny, and it stems from irrational fear of the other. And what I wish people would focus on is the real sources of oppression, which are economic, which are racial, and to look at the real boogeyman here, which is corporate excess, and all the systems that conspire to keep poor people down of any color. Because turning to the guy next to you and blaming him is absolutely not where that rage should be directed.
Christine Palm is a House Democrat in the state of Connecticut, serving Chester, Deep River, Essex, and Haddam. We had a politician call in there. Want to turn now to Bilal to talk about what's happening in Connecticut politics. Are you seeing this kind of in our backyard, this woke pejorative and the way that the phrase is being demeaned? Are you seeing examples of this here?
Let me first say thank you to the representative for saying much more eloquently than I would have been able to say, about these issues. Very quickly, just in sort of response to something that Mordecai said, for me, one of the things I'm always puzzled by is this perception of the academy that often gets presented, and I think, it happens on television, but certainly conservative media, that the academy is this place of this radical left, agenda and other sort of things. And often, I'm also amazed when, something happens and it could be a university in the middle of nowhere where a professor runs into trouble and then the outrage machine jumps into action on the right. And all of a sudden, this becomes a description of everything that goes on in every institution across the country. I think what we're battling with are, for example, what I'm seeing more often now, where we have transgender students who want to be called by their pronoun that they prefer to use. And we have people who resist that, in our society and feel like the wokeness is being forced on them to call people what they self-identify with. And I think that's problematic. And the representative, I think, has really pointed out what's at the core of this. The short answer to your question is that Connecticut has not been a place where we've seen a lot of this moving. Certainly not in the state legislature, which is dominated by the Democrats. We have a statewide control by the Democratic Party, leans progressive in that sense. And so it's highly unlike anything we'll move in the legislature. We may see at the local level some battles over books, for example, or some folks who will become outraged about, something's being taught in the schools, especially around LGBTQ rights or, LGBTQ athletes, transgender athletes. And so we see that flash from time to time, but nothing, really, really serious like we see going on in many other states.
I do want to point out, though, that it's easy to look at Florida or the national to see that, yes, Democrats are in the majority here in Connecticut, so you might not see as many attacks on people or books, but we are still seeing efforts to ban books, restrict gender identity, and more in the state. Obviously, during the DeVos and Trump administration, there was an attack against two trans girls, student athletes that were here in Connecticut, an attack on funding of schools in Connecticut because of their participation in sports. And just some context to add here, there's an example of restricting gender identity that would be a challenge from Republicans in the state legislature to a proposal adding a non-binary gender marker to state forms. And something else I want to point out in terms of the woke pejorative here, Bilal, we're also seeing party leaders in Connecticut invoke the word woke on social media, not the way it's intended to be used originally. Let me read you a tweet from the Connecticut Republican Party's official Twitter account here. When Democrats care more about their woke leftist land use agenda than actually improving the health of our environment, that was in response to some proposals surrounding brownfield remediation. What are your thoughts on this kind of messaging? And do you think it's going to resonate with people in the state?
Yeah. And again, that goes back to my, original point about, these also being attacks on progressive policy, whether it's about protecting the environment or it's about, corporations being socially conscious, diversifying their staff. Think about the collapse of the Silicon Valley Bank, the right. One of the attacks on that bank was to argue that it was because they had overemphasized diversity, as if banks in which mostly white men are in control of have not had financial collapses. And so, again, I think this falls in line, with that. But I'm confident, you know, in Connecticut, and Connecticut is a place where this will not gain traction, at least not at the state legislative level. But I think you're absolutely right. These battles do go on at the local level, and they are fought out with school boards and local leaders. And yeah, and it plays out in that way.
I just want to button up this part of the conversation first, because I got to move on to talking about the 2024 election and if this is actually going to work. But Eric, you mentioned this, and this is really important. The dog whistle aspect of invoking the word woke. Can you just talk about that a little bit more? And then if you can you just talk to us about anti-wokeness and connecting it to the idea of grievance politics?
So the way to think of a dog whistle is people use certain code words, or use certain words that people pick up on. And we can think of the Reagan use of welfare queen. It was clearly a racial dog whistle. And we'll probably see that a lot where woke is being used. It'll be mischaracterized, and it'll be used in a bunch of different ways. That's really not, just like the attack on critical race theory, that they can't define it, but they're scared of it and they have no idea what it is. But this also comes back to this idea of grievance politics, where you're seeing what's coming out of this is when other racial groups give their grievances, what you find is the groups that are in power now have theirs. And that the, and it's seen as the, any growth on the part of women or on the part of racial minorities is seen as automatically as a loss for white men. There's a failure to recognize that many of the civil rights acts passed, the voting rights actually made it easier for poor whites to vote. It made it easier for whites in many ways. And what we're finding is that historically, that groups have used race as a way to break up poor blacks and poor whites, and that this is the new one being used. And there are numerous studies kind of showing that if you just invoke race, you break up any attempt to really push back against those who are in power and those who are being those who are basically economically oppressing individuals and taking advantage of individuals.
56% of people, again, in USA Today saying that they're sort of seeing woke in a favorable light. I guess you might say that the other 39% that were surveyed would be looking at it less favorably as an overly kind of political correct term. Bilal, I wanted to point that out to say 2024 election, this is a big message, this anti-woke kind of message that's being used. Do you think this woke punch is going to land and it can actually work to a DeSantis or somebody like that advantage here?
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly, and Eric could probably speak to this as well, when you think about the primary and receiving the Republican nomination, I think that this will resonate with that base, which tends to be further to the right, more conservative. And I think this issue resonates more with them. Whether you can win a national level campaign about wokeness when other issues like healthcare and, you know, wealth disparity and jobs and the economy and education, I think those issues will matter more.
Eric, just 30 seconds or so left. I'm sorry to do this rather quickly, but there's just been evidence that this is not necessarily resonating, though, with the voters. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't think it's working in certain states, but it's not going to work across the nation. And in fact, it may repulse some people, because again, if you think about what happened in Charlottesville, other places like that, the anti-woke movement is very closely aligned with these individuals.
Mordecai Gordon joining us from the University of Quinnipiac. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Bilal Sekou from the University of Hartford and from the University of Texas at Austin also joining us today. Eric McDaniel, thank you guys for coming on.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to talk next about ranked choice voting. Give us a call, 888-720-WNPR.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In-Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano, and we're going to pivot now away from the war on woke to some news on ranked choice voting in Connecticut. This legislative session, we saw not one, but several bills calling for the implementation of an alternate voting method in the state. But early this week, the Government Administration and Election Committee decided not to advance any of these proposed bills. Still, it got us wondering, what would ranked choice voting look like here? For that and more, we're talking to somebody who covered this issue, Allison Cross, a reporter at the Hartford Courant. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for coming on The Wheelhouse. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And if you have a question, a quick question, we're hoping, on ranked choice voting, give us a call, 888-720-9677. Allison, before we get to the news here of what happened this week, in basic terms, what is ranked choice voting?
So like the name says, ranked choice voting allows voters to select their candidates by ranking their candidates in order of how much they like them, essentially. So how it works is you would get your ballot, you would label your candidates number 1 through 5, and in the counting process, a candidate needs to get 50% of the vote in order to win. So in that first round, they count all those first choice votes, and if a candidate gets 50%, that candidate is the winner. But if there's not a 50%, then whoever got the lowest number of votes gets eliminated from the race and immediately goes on to count the second choice votes for whoever voted for that candidate. And they're redistributed until a candidate gets 50% of the vote, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and Allison, this is different from what we currently have now, which I understand it's called, I always think of it as you pick a candidate, but it's the single choice plurality. Is that correct?
Yes. So for that system, the candidate doesn't necessarily need to get 50% of the vote. As we know, it's just the majority.
And what were some of the specifics of the bills before the state legislature? Can you just, before we talk about how it failed, can you just tell us about what was actually in these bills?
So these bills ranged from everywhere from ranked choice voting on the municipal, state, federal elections, and all together too. It also included for primaries, general elections. So it really included any proposal for this.
And why do we see ranked choice voting fail to advance this legislative session? Why do you think it stalled?
So I think a big part of it was that Connecticut's Secretary of the State, Stephanie Thomas, said that with Connecticut's current voting infrastructure, ranked choice voting isn't possible. We have something called optical scan tabulators, and it's just not able to handle a ranked choice vote. So in order to push this through, we would need entirely new voting machines. It would cost a lot of money. But I think another big part was there wasn't really an overwhelming amount of public support that we saw in the public hearing of the people who submitted testimony. There's about 60 people testifying in support and 50 in opposition. And for some of these public hearings, lawmakers can see hundreds of people testify. So there really wasn't an overwhelming push, I guess you could say.
Before we continue our conversation, Allison, I got a question from a listener in North Haven. Rob, go ahead. What do you got to say?
Yes, I was calling, and it has to do somewhat with the ranked choice voting, but with the Electoral College, is there any potential to have that be broken down where if a candidate gets 50, 56 or 60% of the votes in a state, they get an appropriate number of electoral college votes. It basically breaks it down without counting a first or a second choice. It would just appropriate that appropriate number of votes towards that candidate, and then it would be more of a distribution.
So you're asking if we would split the electoral college like a Nebraska does or something like that?
Yeah, similar to that, where it could, if you win a like 70%, you get 70% of the electoral college votes for that state, and maybe not just Connecticut, but all the states, if there's any movement towards that, because it would be more indicative and represent the general population and vote if it was like that, instead of win 51%, get all the electoral college votes.
Rob, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate that. Allison, is that anything you're aware of this session, if that's been any conversation or any conversation at large here in Connecticut about potentially splitting the electoral vote?
Not that I know of right now.
Thank you for answering that question for us, Allison. I appreciate that. And I want to kind of talk further about ranked choice voting and figuring out here if the idea behind it is to boost third-party candidates. I mean, why do people support it? What are proponents of ranked choice voting saying in Connecticut?
So supporters really see this as a way to save our democracy. That was something I was hearing a lot in the public hearing. They don't think the current system is working, and they see this as the solution. They think it will increase voter turnout, create positive issue-based campaigning, and it's not necessarily to boost third-party candidates as much as it is to prevent those spoiler votes. So essentially, if you vote for a third-party candidate and they get knocked out in the first round, your second-choice vote can then count. And it really, but part of the goal is to move away from the polarized two-party system and focus more on the candidates and more on the issues than the parties itself.
What about opponents of ranked choice voting? What are they saying?
They see it as confusing, complicated, time-consuming. They think that the amount of time and the questions with the system will create more election integrity questions. They think that it will actually turn people away from the polls because it'll require too much research to know how to rank your choices. But their big concern is exhausted ballots, which happens when if you only vote for a first choice candidate and you don't decide to rank anyone else, if that candidate gets knocked out, you don't have any other votes to add to the system. So they say that for the longest time in America, it's been one vote. And that's the way it should stay.
Opponents to ballot access are always complaining about delays in getting results out and then throwing up challenges or something like that. Do we know if ranked choice voting would result in any kind of delays in finding out a winner or anything like that? Did that get bandied about this legislature session?
Well, the way that it works with the tabulators is it's very instant. It's the computers and the machines doing it for you. But I think especially the way that America is right now, where they're with the last presidential election, how many questions popped up with people not trusting the results. I think that's part of the fear that if we add more confusion, it could elevate that.
Very quickly, where do we see ranked choice voting in the United States?
So right now, two states, Maine and Alaska, have ranked choice voting. There's also dozens of municipalities and about 16 states in the U.S. that also use it for local elections. New York City is probably the largest. We also see it in Australia. They've been using the process since 1918 for their federal elections.
A quick note on those who don't use ranked choice voting. Tennessee doesn't allow ranked choice voting in state and local elections. Florida outlawing ranked choice voting. So we know that the legislation did stall in Connecticut, but is this something that you can see happening maybe next year? Were there any positives associated with ranked choice voting this year, Allison? What do you have to say?
I think there is a lot of support, especially amongst leaders in the state. Governor Ned Lamont was a big proponent of it. He's on the campaign trail. He said he supported it. And then in his inaugural remarks, he supported it once again. There was more than 20 Democratic lawmakers and one Republican lawmaker who signed on to sponsor these bills. So I do think it's something, a type of election reform that a lot of people are thinking about, and people on both sides of the aisle see the benefits. I think it's just right now a matter of education and getting people to understand it.
And it got a public hearing this year, and you'd know that if you followed Allison's reporting. Allison Cross from the Hartford Courant, thank you so much for joining us on The Wheelhouse this morning.
Thank you.
Today's show produced by Meg Dalton. Thank you so much for producing this. Our technical producer is Kat Pastor, and of course, the real MVPs today, especially with me juggling the calls here. Superstar colleagues, Tess Terrible and Katie Talarski, thank you so much for helping us in studio this week. Download The Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for listening. This is The Wheelhouse for Connecticut Public. I'm Frankie Graziano.